Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. Today's guest is the wonderful Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, a friend, mentor, and former power agent who has been one of my great life teachers.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm an author, podcast host, and parent who built a long career in media. I grew up in a state of perpetual curiosity, investigating the world and asking a lot of questions. In this show, I chat with culture-defining leaders, thinkers, and experts about this rare moment that we find ourselves in and how to think about our own lives and experiences within a larger social and spiritual construct.
I didn't want to be still. I had to be still, but I wanted more than anything to continue being a human doing. And the universe was insisting that I became a human being. And it's profound. I mean, it's the greatest transformation of my life. You know, I went from being extremely supported on a business perspective to having to go buy stamps, and it takes me all day to mail a letter. You know, I'm only able to do what I can do in a day. And I love it. I really love it because, as I often said, like, I can do bad all by myself. I don't need somebody else confirming a reservation and rubbing somebody the wrong way so that when I get there, the energy is weird. It's like, now if I get somewhere and the energy is weird, it's because of me.
So says Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, a dear friend and mentor who in her prior life was the global head of literature and lectures and events at WME, the agency. During her long and storied career, she shepherded many of culture's biggest luminaries, including Oprah, Brene Brown, and Sue Monk Kidd. And while yes, Jennifer is an amazing dealmaker who can look for synergies across industries so that everyone wins, I believe her particular genius point is finding the story. I have watched her work with people where their story, which they perceived as messy, random, unimportant, comes together in her eyes as a cogent, powerful narrative. It is incredible to witness and truly transforms that person's perspective on their entire life. In fact, for many years, Jennifer and others led a Together Live storytelling tour where they went all over the country listening to stories and telling them in a way that brought audiences to their feet in resonance. She is one of my friends and mentors. On any given day, she might be my mother, my sister, or as she would joke, my daughter. And I have learned so much from watching her navigate the world with fierceness and power. In today's conversation, she talks about her transition into a sacred pause as she contemplates how she wants to serve in this next phase of her career. And we explore story as both a tool for personal healing and an opportunity for societal change. Let's get to our conversation. The first time I interviewed you, I barely knew you.
That's right. Isn't that right. That was my favorite interview ever.
Oh.
But you're amazing at it, but also you're so delicious that I wanted to spend all my time reversing the questions onto you.
You
it's
said,
like, tell me everything.
You said, you say many things to me that I take on the road, but you said something to me too that I loved, which you said, I don't need to be a thought leader. This emphasis on cultural thought leaders, I don't think you said it was bullshit, but you were like, there's enough of that. I'm just a thought follower.
Yeah. And that's very much true to this day. I love following a great thought or a great story and just taking it to wherever it leads me.
Yeah.
And then sharing it, because I'm a fanatic when it comes to something that I've learned that's beautiful or that's true or that's sad or that's helpful. I just want to tell everybody about it too.
But this is what I think is one of your more remarkable gifts. And obviously you spent your life finding, cultivating, and setting talent free in the world, but you're an incredible storyteller yourself. Like, I feel like you hear the thing and then can articulate it in a way that's actually so much better than the event.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I do say that I'm the queen of the cliche, and I don't say that to put myself down. I mean, I think it's actually quite something to always have the perfect cliche for every situation. And I come by it naturally because in the birthday book, February 14th, my birthday, is the day of the quick quip.
Really?
So yeah. So well, that book is amazing. So I will say that I do have the ability to sum up kind of a rather large and sometimes confusing experience with just like a two-sentence thing that just cuts to the core. So I appreciate that I'm moving energy through those ideas. And a lot of the stories I tell, I can't even remember where they come from because I am an amalgamation of all the thoughts I've followed.
It's true. It's really interesting. I mean, I'm thinking, I've watched you do this innumerable times. And I'm thinking of one instance where it was this prompt. Because I think, okay, this is the other thing that I think is a cultural misfire. The storytelling is left to writers, poets, musicians, artists, right? And some people are more creatively equipped than others. And so many people's stories don't get told because they don't have that skill set, or maybe they're co-opted or appropriated in a way that's maybe honoring and respectful, but often not. And then so many people think that they don't have a story.
Right. Well, I would like to separate out, if we can, the idea of publishing your story with telling your story. Because I do think they've gotten kind of conflated. And while it is my most firm belief that every single person has a story and that story matters, I wouldn't add to that and every single person's story should be published or produced.
Right.
Because they're separate things. I mean, a published story or a produced story is a work of art. Everybody that has a story that can share their story is a work of healing. Mm. And they're very, very different things. I mean, I'm not saying that there's not an art to the healing. But when I say that everybody has a story and that story matters, I believe that to my core. But people don't always know what their story is. And you and I were at an event together, and we asked the prompt, tell me about that scar. And a woman that we were with, who we adore, said, I don't really think I have a story about a scar. And I said, really? And she said, let me think. Oh, wait, I do. My father, who committed suicide, was bipolar. And when he was very manic, he would be wonderful to be around. And he was swinging me around by my legs. And I smashed my head into the side of a chair. And I was gushing blood, but I didn't want him to know that I was hurt because I didn't want it to stop. Now, this person didn't think they had a story.
Mm.
That story is gigantic.
Yeah.
And universal on so many levels and explains so much about this person. But she started it by saying, I don't really have a story about a scar.
Yeah. And then didn't she go on to talk about needing to go to the emergency room and then in that moment trying to comfort her parents?
Yep. Comfort her mother and comfort her father and being the go-between. I mean, her story was ginormous.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, we were all in tears and we looked at her completely differently. But she was walking through the world as a person who didn't believe she had a story.
Yeah. Where does that, I don't even know if I'd call it an essential wound, but since we're talking about scars, why not? Where does that come from?
Well, I think that I'm not going to say that people come into two different categories because that's too reductive. But I do think people tend to either think I have the hugest story or I don't have a story.
Yeah.
And I can talk about my own journey from midwifing 2,000 books into the world and thinking that I didn't have a story to tell, to realizing that I couldn't be going around the world telling everybody that you have a story and that story matters and thinking that it didn't apply to me.
Right.
So part of my journey was to realize, oh, I also have a story and that story matters. And even though the nadir of my young childhood wound was my parents getting divorced, which is pretty ordinary and happens to probably 50% of all kids in this country, it doesn't mean that my story is ordinary. Mm-hmm. And the way my parents' divorce impacted me is unique. And in sharing that story, I was able to travel the distance from the personal to the universal.
And you shared that story in the introduction to Hungry Hearts, but will you tell it in summation here?
Yes. Yeah, so when I was a young girl, my parents told us that we were going to have a family meeting after school. I had never been to a meeting. I couldn't have been more excited. I ran around school like a mad hatter, asking every single person what happens at a family meeting. And the consensus was that my family was going on a vacation and that this meeting was going to be used to decide where we were going to go. So I spent that afternoon, I got myself a yellow legal pad. I tried to make the strongest argument that I could about how Disneyland was an educational experience. I knew my brother would probably be voting for Cooperstown, the baseball place. And I knew my sister would want to go someplace glamorous. And I just realized I had to make my case. And so I got to the meeting all ready to advocate for my choice. And my parents told us they were getting divorced. Mm. And I literally sat there clutching that yellow pad, feeling like my entire life was over. And feeling like there was no way back to the person I was entering that meeting. And I carried that division and that schism inside of myself for many, many years.
So interesting, knowing you in the way that I know you now too, that, and I can't imagine it wasn't your gift before this experience, but you strike me, well, one, I don't love, but the vulnerability that you express, like when you're surprised by someone's action, is so sweet.
Well, I mean, you know, a friend of mine said to me just 3 years ago at work, something was happening and it was really not going well. And I bumped into my friend at the airport and he goes, Jen, your parents are not getting back together and we're not going to Disneyland. And it's like, oh, I've literally been carrying around this desire to get the family back together and going to Disneyland to the point where on Together Live, I actually named the last portion of the show, the family meeting. Like in my own way, I had been trying to redo that meeting over and over again and keep myself from being blindsided and keep my family from being divided.
Yeah. So first, what I've observed in you is this anticipatory emotional reading of everyone involved and understanding what they need and how to fulfill those needs, which I'm assuming was your gift before, but now you've supercharged it in order to anticipate what's going to happen so that you're not taken by surprise. You're still taken by surprise.
Always.
Always.
Always. My friend Suzanne says I'm like Lucy with the football. Not again! But yeah, I'm always taken by surprise because there is such a purity in my belief of other people and in my belief of the power of love and the power of story. Yeah. So, I mean, the reason I love stories so much is because there's a beginning, middle, and an end. But in real life, the beat just goes on and on.
It really does, with no tidy summation.
That's right.
But let's talk about family because you look for it. I mean, you've said it to me before when we've gone to meet someone. You're like, you're meeting the rest of your family and friends and family. Like you can sense it in the way that you gather people around you who you love and protect them fiercely. How do you take that and extend that? Like, how do you turn that into a culture? I mean, and we were just talking about sort of the flip side of that, which is companies that insist on pretending like they're your family and then are not, which I think has been a cultural fallout from COVID for so many people, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the extension is the belief that every single solitary person matters and their humanity is at the very core of that value. And if you don't lose sight of somebody's humanity, no matter what, even in the most defended position, then it really enables you to sort of see everybody as your brother or your sister or your child. Mm. And I mean, certainly that's aspirationally the way I like to treat people.
When I was in my early 20s and let's just say not living my best life, my late brother-in-law and best friend, Peter, took me to France. Ostensibly, we were going to see and stay with his aunt, but really, I think he wanted to cheer me up. We went to the flea markets in the countryside on the weekends, where I found a set of very old religious medals. I decided to invest these medals with the belief that everything in my life could shift, and it did. I figured out how to frame them myself very badly, and they've stayed with me ever since. When Peter passed away in 2017, these medals became even more important to me, earning pride of place next to my desk. I look at them every day. But my poor framing job from 2002 started to fail recently, and so I decided to entrust them to Framebridge. I've been having Framebridge frame all of my family photos for years. You can upload digital prints, and they do a beautiful and speedy job, making them the perfect place for holiday gifts, as my mother-in-law and parents treasure photos of my kids. But Framebridge also takes on objects that are typically expensive and difficult to frame, whether it's menus, tickets, original artwork, personal milestones, license plates, hotel keys, keys to your first home, or in my case, medals. You can easily order online at framebridge.com or visit one of their 20-plus Framebridge retail stores. They provide free, secure prepaid packaging for physical items, and you can ship them on over. They will then frame your piece and ship it to you in days. It's easy. It's affordable. You know exactly what it will cost up front, and they offer every conceivable framing option. Everything I've ever sent Framebridge has always looked even better than I expected. Plus, if you're not 100% happy with your piece, they'll make it right. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything. That's framebridge.com. Well, one of the things that I'm very grateful to you for many reasons. One, sort of your bravery in holding people's hands regardless of what they're going through and how unsavory it might be. But two, your unwavering and sometimes painful honesty, right? Like, you will say the thing.
Well, I mean, I will say that, you know, brutal honesty is only brutal if it's intended to be. So I try to always come to honesty with as much compassion and kindness as I can. But I do think the ultimate sign of respect and admiration is honesty, which is to say that when you look away from something that somebody is going through, or when you're only there for the good times, there's a very painful tear that happens inside a person when the messages they're being told are you're only valuable or worthy when things are going well. And so I try very hard, because I know what that feels like, to not be more attentive to the hard times, because they're also the friends that are always there when things are going bad, because that's sort of their lifeblood in some way. But I just look at it all, the good stuff, the hard stuff, the boring stuff, as like the most important thing. And so I try to be there equally for all of it and not weight the good stuff over the bad stuff.
Yeah. Going back to honesty, and then I do want to talk about friendship and the different types. It's true that, and I feel like so often people are dishonest because they're scared, right, or because they fear losing the attachment. And in a way, you lost the attachment, right? Like, your family fell apart in some
right.
way.
Yeah.
And do you think that that's made you braver?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You just made me think of something. My father, I used to go to my father's house every other weekend. And my stepmother, who recently passed away, she and I had a pretty difficult relationship, but we never really discussed anything. And when I was in my early 20s, I said to my father one day, how come we never talked about anything? And he said, because I didn't want to risk the weekend. And the irony is, because he didn't want to risk the weekend, we risked our relationship. Because he didn't want to have a bad weekend, we never had a true weekend. And so I've thought about that a lot, like the risking of the weekend. And it's like, I'm willing to risk anything to be real and to be true. And as I said, I do think it's the highest form of respect. I mean, you and I were laughing earlier today because, you know, we had to come up with we were doing a workshop together, and we had to come up with 9 words that defined ourselves. And I couldn't get to my 9 words because I was so busy arguing with you about your words. It's like, why do you fucking care about my 9 words? It's like, because you're spectacular, but we're going to get these words right.
No. Another thing I'm very grateful to you for is you're one of the strongest people I know. You're certainly one of the fiercest women I know. There aren't enough of us, right? And you, in some ways, have taught me how to fight and have conflict and love. I mean, I don't even know if you'd consider it that way.
Well, you're being so sweet, but you're killing me. You know, I can take anything but a compliment. But what I will say is that I do feel very comfortable in disagreements and in conflicts. Because I don't feel like, and I was with this way with my kids, like, if you've done something wrong, there's a consequence, but you're not in trouble. Like, right. You have to pay a consequence. But I love you, and I'm as proud of you when you're sitting in time out as I am when you're sitting on the stage accepting an award. So I think that there's a way to have conflict, resolve conflict, but where the bond is unshakable underneath. And there's never a moment during that conflict where you feel like the love is in danger of being taken away from you.
Right. No, I was talking to Gabor Mate, and he was talking about the essential nature for children. And since I think of myself as your child sometimes.
Which of course you are.
But
my best one.
How the simultaneous needs of any child for attachment and your favorite word, authenticity. And so often children sacrifice authenticity for the attachment, which makes a tremendous amount of sense. Like, you're bartering for your safety and security.
Right.
And I think what you've taught me as an adult is both can be present. Who taught you that?
Well, I actually had to teach that to myself. Okay. Because I didn't have that growing up. And I felt that there had to be a way where you could actually be heard and be seen and have your needs met, but not have to feel like your safety was in question. And I know that with my kids, for example, when they were at Chelsea Day School, which I loved, was the woman that ran the school, Jean, was so wise about stuff like this. So if a child did something wrong, she wouldn't make them apologize because she felt like she was forcing them to be insincere. And what she helped me to realize is the way to do it is they pay the consequence, but then afterwards you ask them if they're sorry, and the answer is yes, what are you sorry for? Mm-hmm. What exactly are you sorry for? And you realize that most children don't really have a sense of what they're sorry for. They're sorry that they're in trouble, really, is what it is. But if you let them come to it on their own, the consequence is paid. They don't have to say they're sorry. They've already paid the price. But that they can come to the idea of their part of the equation themselves if they don't feel like their safety is in question. And I came to realize at a young age that anytime I had a conflict with somebody, particularly somebody that I cared about, I would make myself be quiet until I can think of one part of it that I was sorry for. Literally one part of it. It could be the smallest thing. But until I could find something that I felt that I had mismanaged, then I wouldn't speak. And I would find the more I did that, the easier it was for me to find the thing that I was sorry for.
Mm. So powerful.
It really is. It really is. And it takes you out of that victim consciousness, right? It's like, even in the times where I feel like I've been most wronged, I can still find a place where I feel like I could have communicated better. I could have been more transparent. I could have been less reactive. And being able to lead with what my responsibility is and what I had wish I had done differently, I find that very liberating and empowering. And the interesting thing is I think people think that it's a weakness. You know, never apologize, never explain. I'm the opposite. It's like, apologize, explain.
Yeah.
It's like true connection is on the other side of that.
Yeah. I was interviewing this psychotherapist, Galit Atlas. He wrote this really beautiful book about emotional inheritance. And anyway, she's Syrian, Iranian, Israeli, and she was talking about Israel in this context, but it from the micro to the macro, she was like, it's really difficult when people get so mired in their victim consciousness, which we all want and need, and never deny anyone their suffering.
Right.
And then simultaneously to recognize, or how unable so many people are to recognize when they have slipped to be the aggressor. And so often we never take responsibility for that.
That's right.
And it could be 95% victim, 5% aggressor, but there's always a projection of our pain, typically, on someone else.
Right, right. I mean, for one thing, we're all the things. And certainly as children, you know, my child would never. It's like, never, not yet. You know, I mean, every child, everything, every time, you know. And it's developmentally appropriate. And we like to see ourselves as one thing, but we're microclimates. We're many things, and we're many things in many different situations. And, you know, back to the story piece, which is, you know, my religion. I'm a storytelling evangelist. But the reason I am is because once you know somebody's story, you can never look at them as other again. You take them into your heart in a completely different way. I mean, somebody was just asking me about Blackberry Mountain. Now, Blackberry Mountain is the most incredible place, but all I can think about is Celeste's story, Celeste Beale, the woman who runs it, whose husband suddenly died and left her with four children. Like, the story is the thing that lasts. It's the tattoo on your heart. And if you really let somebody's story in, it changes the way, not just the way you think about them, the way you think about yourself.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's such a powerful, like, magic medicine for connection and healing. And words, the scaffolding of how we understand stories, are constantly changing.
No, it's interesting too. Going back to how we started with this idea that only certain people get to really tell their story. Like, what are the forums? Like, how do we accelerate this idea of, I mean, we've talked about it a lot in the context of a dream that we have to build. of not badging, which sounds so gamified, but this idea that so many people have been through so many things that are imperceptible unless expressed. And I wish we had a culture that made it like you had your Girl Scout
badge. Right. No, you know, we do believe in this, right? You know, that you can go up to somebody and say, hello. And instead of making small talk, you see a badge that said, my family lost all their money and we had to move houses 12 times. It's like, oh, now we can have a totally different conversation. Let's have a real conversation.
Yeah.
You know, because my grandfather also came from a family that had lost all their money and or also had a parent die by suicide or whatever it is. We hide the things that actually make us most compelling to one another because we've been sold a belief that that's what where our weakness is as opposed to that's where our beauty is. I mean, look, social media makes it so easy but to share our stories, but there's more to the process than just sort of sharing blindly. I mean, there has to be an understanding of who you're sharing with and a certain safety that you're not going to be judged or held or held responsible for something that is not your responsibility. So I do think that sharing stories are incredibly powerful, but that there has to be an awareness of safety and you have to know who is witnessing you in your full humanity.
Yeah, certainly. And then there's this might be a different type of thing, but I've seen you give feedback to people who feel like they really need to share their story because it has universal truth. But in the sense they haven't processed their story, they haven't metabolized it, they might be covered with sort of gaping wounds.
Well, you've heard me say before, you know, you really need to share from the scar and not from the wound. Because when you're sharing from a wound, I think that's more for a, you know, potentially for a therapeutic setting or for a very close, you know, close personal friend or a family member. The problem when you share from the wound is that it's dangerous for the person sharing from the wound, but it's also dangerous for the people who are listening.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
Well, I think that it can be potentially very triggering to hear somebody sharing from an open wound. And those people sometimes haven't processed everything entirely, and they can potentially be inadvertently dangerous to somebody else with how they're sharing.
Yeah.
So I do think that digesting the story and really working through the pieces of it is central for it to be part of like healing and connection.
Yeah. And again, going to that sort of the owning of some part of it, which I think potentially when you're projecting from an open wound, it is almost, you can become an aggressor, as you were saying, inadvertently.
Right. I mean, I think that without realizing it, because the feelings are so wild and unprocessed.
And painful.
Exactly. There is like a, you know, there is a almost primal experience. And I think those are ideally best suited for therapeutic settings or for somebody who really knows you so well and is able to kind of sift through the parts of the story that are essential and maybe get rid of some of the woundology.
Yeah, woundology.
Well, woundology to me is the use of your wounds to manipulate somebody else's behavior.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, a necessary part of healing. I mean, you know, I don't blame people. You know, I'm a big, you know, when my husband 15 years ago had cancer, I was like, here's a cancer card. Use it every single day for 12 months. Like, never hesitate. Just put that card down. Like, I'm a believer in processing your wounds, and woundology is a piece of it, but you can't get stuck there.
Yeah.
And it's not really a place to connect and heal from.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've had this conversation with some friends who are psychiatrists, therapists, et cetera, and they do talk about when the attachment to story becomes unwanted luggage, right? And we certainly know people who are so attached to their story, they can't find a new one.
Right. Well, I mean, like all things, right? We can get addicted to an identity, and a story can be an identity. And I remember on the stage of Together Live, Bozema St. John, who wrote a beautiful essay in the Hungry Hearts anthology, she told a story about how she's a widow, and every year on the anniversary of her husband's death, she would write this huge thing on Instagram and get the 2,000 comments, and it was a beautiful healing experience. But this year that we were having this interview, it was like the seventh year, and she thought of the idea of having to write that whole post again and having all the people come to her with their sympathy. It just felt like a lead blanket, and she suddenly realized that she didn't need to do it that way anymore, that she could still love and honor the memory of her husband without having to go to the like the darkest, saddest, most brokenhearted place. And so it's a brave thing to let go of an identity and a label and a story that's given you sympathy and given you support. But we do outgrow our stories. And if we want to write, you know, as Brené says, a brave new ending, we got to stop telling the same stories over and over again.
Oh, it's such a powerful idea. And it's so hard to do. But I think that there is that moment, right? Particularly when you're done processing, when, not that the story stops being relevant, but it certainly might lose its barbed teeth. It might stop feeling so essential to who you are. And you do want to put it down.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, the person who just tells the same stories over and over again, and they're not even listening to themselves anymore. Yeah. That's not an interesting story.
Yeah.
I mean, part of an open-hearted, authentic sharing has to be that the person that is telling the story is also connected to the story.
Yeah.
And therefore connected to you in the witnessing of it.
Yeah.
So when someone's just like phoning it in, or sort of what my phrase is, playing themselves on TV, it's like, then it's not really interesting. Then it's sort of like a verbal masturbation at a certain point. It's like, I just happen to be in the audience.
Right.
And I already saw the matinee, so I don't need to see the nighttime show.
Right. And when the story starts to feel like a manipulation, like when it's, this guy Jamie Wheel calls it like your carpet bag of catharsis, where he talks about the experience of, you see someone telling something and you're like, oh, that's really moving. And then you see them telling the exact same thing to someone else for the same effect. And it's like a deadening of that connection.
Right, right. That for some reason reminds me of the Seinfeld, where Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character like meets this guy and he calls her delicious and she's so excited, and then she overhears him calling like the couch delicious and the dog delicious, and just like how upset she is because she thought it was like the best compliment ever. And that is me with the word delicious. But yeah, it's deadening and it makes you feel like you're oddly being used, and that's right. You know, it's like you're just an audience for them to get off on.
Yeah,
that's not connection.
Hosting this podcast is a great privilege. I'm so grateful to all of you for listening, and to the amazing teachers and thinkers and experts who join me every week. There's nothing better than going deep with someone who has spent a good amount of their life thinking about the issue in question. It's like going back to school. So what's another place to learn from some of the most remarkable experts alive today? Masterclass. There are over 180 masterclass instructors, including experts in leadership, negotiation, writing, and cooking. You can learn from former FBI agent Chris Voss, who teaches negotiation, Carla Welch, who teaches personal style, Bobby Brown, who teaches us how to put on makeup, which is a new fascination for me, or Esther Perel, who teaches relational intelligence. Don't miss Esther's recent episode on pulling the thread. These instructors become your own personal mentors, helping you gain real-life skills. I use Masterclass, and you should too. There are more than 200 classes to pick from, with new ones added every month. For example, my good friend and former Pulling the Thread guest, Emily Morse, is on there teaching about sex and communication. And if there's anyone you want to invite into the bedroom with you and your partner, it should be her. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/thread. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/thread. masterclass.com/thread. All right, friendship, relationships, which you've also taught me a lot about. Can you talk about this idea of like the different types, from transactional, which are completely acceptable?
Right.
But often we confuse those with right. Something deeper.
Well, I think that transactional relationships are, you know, vital, and certainly vital to the workplace. But transactional friendships, I think, is where the gray zone gets kind of confusing. And I think as long as there's transparency and both people are viewing it the same way, then there is no issue. But if one person, Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, is viewing it as a true love friendship and the other person is treating it as a transaction, that's where the pain and the discomfort comes in. And so for me, in the 2.5 years since I've left my work, which was very much a people business and very much for me a business of love, but for a lot of the other side of it, really much more transactional than I recognized. When I left work, I, as a result of COVID, found myself in an opportunity of being still for the first time in my entire life. I had been moving 1,000 miles an hour my entire adult life. And I suddenly found myself at a sacred pause where I just realized that the most powerful luxury that I could give myself was the luxury of stillness, with no plan of how long it was going to be and no idea where it was going to lead me. I just decided that peace was the energy that I was going to cultivate every day, and whatever I had to do to keep the peace was going to be how my day went. And in that process, I recognized the lack of reciprocity that I had kind of fostered in a lot of my relationships. And a big piece of it was that it was easiest to always be the person doing and the person giving. Mm-hmm. And I really thought there was a certain honor in never being the person that received. Mm. And I told myself a powerful story about that. But the truth of the matter was, I really very much wanted to be in the receiving end of things. And I wanted reciprocity. And I wanted to be held as much as I wanted to hold people. And I wanted intergenerational wisdom that went in both directions. And the sacred pause has really given me the opportunity to sort of shed whatever being in a powerful business position, whatever that shadow that was cast for people is gone now. I can't do anything for people professionally. I'm not looking to, but I can hold the space and I can laugh and I can, you know, make some food and we can have a great time and we can cry and we can tell each other things and we can hold those stories inside of our hearts. But it's not transactional for me. I'm not really interested in the transaction anymore. And so that's been a distinction that I've definitely shared and I've modeled.
Yeah. I mean, it's so powerful, that stripping down. And it's interesting, having been present for your sacred pause, as you call it, which is the best phrase ever, and then watching you resist and try and sort of stagger to your feet and then like getting knocked back out.
That's right. I didn't want to be still. I had to be still, but I wanted more than anything to continue being a human doing. And the universe was insisting that I became a human being. And it's profound. I mean, it's the greatest transformation of my life. You know, I went from being extremely supported on a business perspective to having to go buy stamps and it takes me all day to mail a letter. You know, I'm only able to do what I can do in a day. And I love it. I really love it because, as I often said, like, I can do bad all by myself. I don't need somebody else confirming a reservation and rubbing somebody the wrong way so that when I get there, the energy is weird. It's like, now if I get somewhere and the energy is weird, it's because of me.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I love it. And I mean, I'm, you know, at this point in my life, I'm relearning things that a lot of people, you know, learned in their 20s and their 30s. And because of the way my career went, I farmed out a lot of the parts of my life. And, you know, now I get to do all the things that I farmed out, and I'm, you know, I'm really not very good at a lot of them. I mean, I try not to say I suck. Instead, I say I'm a beginner.
Yeah. A beginner driver.
Yeah. I'm a beginner. I'm a beginner at so much of this stuff. I'm a beginner at running errands. I'm a beginner at driving. I'm a beginner at doing things for myself in a way that you can say, oh, you know, oh, poor you. Well, you know what? I just didn't do those things for 30 years. So with no value judgment on them, I'm learning to do them now.
Yeah. But it's interesting, sort of going back to what you said, which was so powerful and made me want to hug you. But this role that you, this JRW, right? One of the most powerful literary agent. I mean, don't slap me across the table, but this fierceness that you exhibit on behalf of other people, the veil of protection, the arm of protection, the going to the mat to ensure that the people that you love are under your care are taken care of appropriately. And then what I recognize in you in this desire, and I've experienced that. I mean, I'm not your client. I haven't experienced it as in a business sense, but I've experienced it as your child, adopted child. But it's really powerful to hear you say how you also want that for yourself.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And it's a powerful desire to want to give what you want to also receive.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, certainly for me, you know, we said, you and I talk about what are some labels you've outgrown, right? Yeah. JRW is one of them. I don't respond to that anymore. Like, I understand that those are my initials, but JRW has an energy in the world that I am not interested in any longer. I'm grateful to that energy. I'm grateful to all the things that it helped me do in the world. to the ease in which I'm able to live my life as a result of it, to the stories that I helped birth into the world. But I'm not interested in walking into a room 6 feet before I get in there. I don't want my shadow. I want my light.
Mm.
And I very much want to connect insides to insides with people. And so, you know, that's why I moved to California, because I wanted to be in a place where I wasn't known for certain things.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just take walks with your chiropractor who you connect me with, or with the real estate agent that rented me my rental. Like, I just wanted to be able to connect with people, not based on what I could do for them or what they could do for me, but based on what we have in common and what we can learn from each other and where our stories overlap and where they're completely different. And I just find the quality of those relationships to be so exciting and liberating and comforting.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because being around you, you have a very, in your 8 Enneagram self, you're a very powerful person. And it is interesting to watch you try to shed. And I recognize, like, some of the baggage of that, of JRW, and I feel like I've done a really good job in retraining myself to say your full name, but...
Or everybody calls me Jen now, which is so funny, because nobody ever called me Jen my whole life. And now just all of a sudden, everyone's just a Jen. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Love it. Jen Walsh.
But you do have that power, and it's interesting to watch you try to break that cycle. I've just been in rooms with you where people... It's like a moth to a flame. And then you're like, I don't understand why people keep coming to me. And it's like, well, that's who you are.
Right. Well, I certainly don't want to stop the magnetic force that brings people towards me. And especially if I'm able to be of service to them, if I'm able to be clarifying, because I am very clear. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that I have clarity, which doesn't mean that I have certainty.
Yeah.
Right? They're very different things. I mean, I don't know, right? How the hell am I supposed to know?
Right.
But I have clarity about how I'm feeling and how I'm experiencing somebody else's feelings.
You're
and
an
experience.
Oracle. You're like a truth touchstone. But it is really interesting to watch how that follows you, even in rooms where you would theoretically be anonymous.
Yeah, well, it doesn't
happen to me.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, literally, I was like, I'm naked getting acupuncture, literally naked. And the acupuncturist, this beautiful woman I met in San Francisco, and she's, you know, doing acupuncture on me. But all of a sudden, I see that she needs to talk about something. And so I like open up the forum between us for her to share. And before I know it, she's sobbing. I'm getting up and hugging her fully naked. Anyway, so no, I don't want to lose that part. I mean, that is the sacred divine inside of me. And it's a spark that was given to me by God. And I don't want to lose that part. But I don't want it to be part of a transaction.
Yeah.
And I don't want it to be...
Is it the expectation?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I used to say at work all the time, come to me for, and I would say 3 C's. It was like the creation of a relationship, crisis, and then celebration. And even when I was leaving my job, I said to people, still come to me for crisis. Because I'm good in a crisis, I think very clearly. But I realized that I don't want people just coming to me with their crisis.
Yeah.
And it's unfair for the few people who kept coming to me with crisis because I had told them that's what I wanted them to do. But then I had to revise it. It's like, if you're not coming to me with the creativity and you're not coming to me for the celebration, like I no longer want to be the human pooper scooper.
Yeah. No, it's interesting.
And I'm okay. And my husband tells me all the time, Jen, it's okay to change your mind.
Yeah.
And that's new to me because I didn't think so. I thought you say your word is your bond. And if you said it, you have to be that way forever.
Yeah.
But it's okay to say, I know I said come to me for crisis, but if that's all you're coming to me for, that doesn't feel reciprocal or nurturing to me. So I'm going to step off that.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Those relationships play out too, where there's certainly, it seems like there's the invisible pattern is that if you, I don't know, like that if there isn't a crisis, if there isn't something to fix, then they won't feel not worthy.
Like that's what's interesting, right?
That's what's interesting.
And yeah. I think that that's why I have to be really careful. And I have been with, well, tell me what's working. What are you excited about right now?
Yeah.
Like let's get into seed planting. You know, let me plant a seed for you. You plant a seed for me. Let's get out of that whole drama cycle because, you know, my daughter Hadley is such a powerful teacher for me. Your birthday mate. And when she was young, kindergarten, first grade, I would say to her, "Oh my God, so tell me who got in trouble today at school." Mm. And it was a way for me to get her to tell stories. But one day she told me, "I don't really like telling you that because it doesn't make me feel comfortable talking about people I care about in a way that is not nice or flattering."
Ooh.
And it really hit me. I was like, I'm reinforcing this idea of bring me drama.
Right. Like conflict entrepreneur.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was so not her nature. It's so not her Sagittarian nature that she was able to articulate it for me in a way that was really eye-opening for me. And I stopped it instantly.
Yeah.
It was like I couldn't unsee that. It was like seeing your sister in a crowd. You can't unsee it. And I never did it again.
Yeah.
Because it's not a healthy correspondence to make people feel like they have to bring you a drama to be interested.
I know. But it's how so many of us bond.
Yeah, we don't though.
Yeah. No, it's
true. I mean, we almost never talk about drama. I mean, if something's hard, we're there. But all the time we're talking about what music we're loving, what show we're watching, what we just read, what we just listened to, you know, an idea we're excited about, a new puffy sleeve sweater, like whatever it is. It's joy.
Yeah.
You know, and we're focused on the light.
Yeah. So, okay, I know you, well, I don't know. I don't think you're going to be in sacred pause forever. But what are those qualities as you reimagine that next chapter? Is there another chapter, another legacy in the world?
And well, the answer is I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I'm never going to do is compete against myself. You know, I feel like I did something for 30 years with my whole heart. I left nothing for the swim home. I'm complete. I'm full. So I don't have something like unfulfilled inside of me. I do love co-creation. I love collaboration, as you well know. And I love watching people reach their potential and setting up the circumstances for them to do that. And I love sharing stories. So all of that is still true. And even though it's been a pause for me compared to the 1,000 things that I used to do, I've still published a book and I'm working on collaborating on this idea of storytelling clubs where people get together and instead of talk about books, talk about their stories. So I'm doing little stuff. You and I are playing with something that we're very excited about transitions, but it's all service through joy for me. I mean, if it's not joyful, it's not happening because it has to beat the joy I get from being in my garden or playing with my dogs or watching TV, which is obviously my all-time favorite thing.
Love is blind.
So, right, Love is Blind Brazil. But so, I mean, there's a high bar for me. And believe me, I never in a million years expected it to be 2.5 years down the road. And I have no idea how much longer it will be because I don't think in terms of timeline anymore. I mean, to be truly surrendered is to just be present in every day for me and to just be so grateful that I get to have this experience of stillness. And I'm not really focused on how being a human being doing is going to look like.
Yeah.
Because right now I'm very focused on just human being.
But how would you, when you think about JRW and then you think about Jen, what are the sides of work that you feel like you haven't got to taste, right? Like what are the parts that you would bring forward and then what would you want to create entirely new?
Okay, that's a great question. I think that what I would love to bring forward is the purity of co-creation and creativity and the power of art and storytelling. I love that. And that's something that even if I just spent the rest of my days, like, you know, never working again, I would be spreading the joy and the light of that. What I never really got to do, I guess, is to create with people something that wasn't in somebody else's name.
Yeah.
Or something that wasn't on behalf of another person. And so I guess if there was something that I would like to do, it would be to create something that was mine too. Something that, you know, that I could love and live inside of, you know, for all the days. And, you know, just to say, you've said so many beautiful things about me. I just want to say, I mean, you inspire me to want to co-create. And your brilliance is only paled by your compassion and your love and your generosity. And so being with somebody like you, who one day is my daughter, the next day is my mother, you know, often my sister, it makes me want to build a cathedral together. And, you know, it makes me want to create opportunities for people to share in all the incredible wisdoms that you've brought to me and into my life.
Oh, thank you. It's so meaningful. Well, if you can't tell, I love Jennifer, who I had always known as JRW, but no more. And she often asks me, and we talk about this in the context of relationships, but it's such an interesting and powerful somatic example. She talks about people where you can like really sit in their lap. And I know that's a strange idea when you're a grown woman, but I think as children, we remember this, like, when were your legs flexed? Like when you're holding your weight off of someone because you're scared to let go versus when you trust someone enough to hold you that you can really release the fullness of yourself into their care. And I think about that a lot. And which of the relationships in my life are ones of full release and where I need to do a little bit more work. Hope you enjoyed the chat. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at theelisepodcast.com. Please sign up for my newsletter. I promise I won't spam you. Or follow me on Instagram at Elise Lunan to get updates on new episodes. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread, available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts, i.e. wherever you're listening right now. I also want to thank you in advance for sharing any episodes with friends who you think might like the show, because that is how podcasts grow. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Serena Reagan, Mary-Kate McDonough, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duval for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.